This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is Friday, which means it's our week in review. And this week, the rubber hit the road. Things we have been waiting for, wondering about, happened. Kids went back to school in districts around the state, and it was a mixed bag. Here's Mayor Marty Walsh talking to parents ahead of Boston's own reopening next Monday.
I would just encourage parents in Boston and throughout the Commonwealth, if your son or daughter wake up and they're not feeling well, your best bet's to let them stay home and remote learn that day, because you just don't know.
A Harvard study put to rest whether there's racial bias in the Commonwealth's criminal justice system. Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz, who commissioned the study, also died this week. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins reflected on the challenge to Governor Charlie Baker to fill Gantz's shoes and increase the court's diversity.
The governor has a lot of opportunity here. I know he's taking this seriously, and I have every faith in the fact that he's going to try to fill these enormous shoes well.
Meanwhile, Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu put months of speculation to rest and announced that she is running to be the city's first woman and person of color to be mayor.
We love our history in Boston. And, you know, the reality as a city that is full of history is we know no one is the first until they do it and it happens.
We'll talk about all of it with our panelists and you. Join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Beginning with your reactions to and your experiences with school reopening this week. How did it go? And do you think it'll work? Now, our panel this week, first is former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. Governor Swift, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Good to have you back as well, Howard.
Hey, Tiziana, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Howard. So, you know, the rubber hit the road on schools this week, both with a huge swath of public schools reopening and with some new challenges around universities and virus spread. Let's start with the public schools, and I'm going to ask you kind of a hokey question. What grade would you each give our public schools in this first wave of reopenings this week? Jane, why don't you go first?
So, Tatiana, I just want to remind you that LearnLaunch, which I run, has a contract with the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, and we are trying to help schools and districts and their leaders with remote and hybrid learning. So I just want to put that out there.
Does give you a unique view of the situation.
Yes, I would give them a passing grade, and I will tell you I'm not giving letter grades because I think we all need to give each other a little grace. No one has ever done this before. It is extremely difficult. There is not going to be a perfect situation, and there are going to be a lot of bumps in the road.
Howard, would you give the same leniency as Jane to this first grade for a school reopening?
Well, I don't think I have any choice, since I was speaking to my 11th grader now, who at the end of remote learning in the 10th grade a few months ago said, they don't give us letter grades anymore. It's all pass fail. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So they just started out here in Northampton, Hampshire County on Wednesday. So they started out 2 days ago and it's completely remote learning. I know he has some of his friends that are doing some of the hybrids. And I think the grace and the leniency and the wait and see is probably the right move right now, simply because the thing that I'm looking for as a parent who's, you know, who's got a child in the system is I thought that the students were checked out at the end last year. And I'm hoping that there is an energy level that the teachers can bring, because nobody knew what to expect last year at the end. And I'm hoping that there's a better plan this year, because I just don't see how much you can get done with these kids doing complete remote learning while they're laying horizontal in bed going to school. It's going to be really difficult.
So WBUR went around the state this week, talked to a bunch of families. I'd like to play some sound. First, Monday was the first day of kindergarten for students at Bowman Elementary in Lexington. Here's Brian Mason talking to WBUR about just being mentally present even for that milestone.
It feels like a different year, trying to have perspective, remember that every year is a different year, so not letting it color the importance and significance and just joy of being able to have them go to school.
And then out in the western part of the state, here's Mustafa and Becky Jean Thompson of West Springfield talking to New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman about this challenge of being working parents while their daughters are learning remotely.
It's about how you've been affected by it thus far, too, and those around you.
I'm going to differ from that, in that it's not a personal decision. It's a pandemic.
But I also think the other side of it is, if people cannot work because their children are home, there's a possibility they could lose their place of residence and not be able to feed their families. So some people don't have a choice.
Jane, what about this rock and this hard place for parents and families? You know, sometimes you live through something, you just got to do it because it's what people have got to do. But is this situation in any way fair, for lack of a better word, for families?
So the equity issues are immense. No, it's not fair. And there are a lot of people who are working very hard to try to establish more equity into the system. I know that the commissioner has asked all schools that as you consider reopening models to look at the equity issues. And so in many districts, the first students who will return to in-person learning are those who are at highest risk, those of high needs. And so that's one way to try to inject some equity into the system. But for parents who have to work, one of the things that we are seeing across the state, and there's been some leniency as well, is the creation of learning pods in community centers with community organizations who are stepping in to try to support parents who need to work.
Listeners, weigh in here. We're talking about public schools, and we're also about to talk about universities in a couple of minutes. What has been your experience so far? Are you prepared? Do you have what you need? How are you feeling your community is handling this kind of gnarly, complex decision-making? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Howard, so now we have several school districts that have, they have had to shift plans and start remote after, wait for it, high school parties. So Lincoln Sudbury, Dover Sherburne. What is the right strategy for cities when you've got sort of that level of non-cooperation with what's necessary to get schools open?
Well, this has been the challenge all summer. You're asking young people to essentially be very responsible and to really sort of not do the things that they consider to be natural. I can't imagine being 16, 17 years old right now and being asked to be one of the more responsible members of a community simply because you do feel like you're invincible. And on top of that, let's not forget that it was only four or five months ago where we were telling or we were following this sort of orthodoxy that the young people weren't going to be the ones who were most affected, that they were young and they were going to get over it and they were going to be okay. And so I think that the question that the governor brings up as well, when she's talking about this sort of leniency, is I don't know what the philosophy is. I know that there have been many people who have said that this is good to get kids back into the school so they'll be more responsible because they're getting the payoff of seeing other people, of seeing their friends and having a bit of normalcy. And then on the other hand, I've heard other folks say that there's no possible way that this is going to work because once they all start seeing each other, they're going to want to party and spend time with each other and be social.
Governor Swift, in a minute, we'll get to the universities. I want to stay in the high schools and public schools for a minute and point out that there are six new cities and towns added to the high-risk list this week. How hard is it? You've been a governor. This is, you know, there's this weird combination of voluntary compliance and mandates with and without teeth that we seem to be putting together across the Commonwealth. How do we do this effectively?
So I think you've seen that the public believes that the governor has done a good job. You know, in Massachusetts, in many parts of the country, we have local control and we are having a struggle where the state has been giving guidance by giving these color systems to local districts, but then allowing them to make their own decisions. Districts, on the one hand, would like more direction, but on the other hand, are making their own choices. And so I think that unfortunately, the virus doesn't respect boundaries as much as in from town to town. And we have to be prepared to respond. And most importantly, we have to protect the health and well-being of our children as well as our communities.
Let's go to the phones on this, and then we'll move on to Boston College and the city of Newton, which is interesting this week, too. We've got Robert on the line from Arlington. Robert, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm actually a Boston Public School teacher, and it's great that I'm hearing the show now because I actually just left my school about 10 minutes ago after 9 days of professional development and preparing my classroom. And I just want to reiterate, I heard one of your guests, I don't recall who said it, but we're all new to this and we're all doing our best. It is a very anxious time for all of us, and I definitely feel for the parents and the families of my students. I would love to be in person. I miss my students terribly, but we want to do it in a safe manner, and if that includes emotionally safe as well. And just that I like that one of your other calls said grace. You know, that's, I think we all need to have that right now because we're all trying to do our best for our young people.
Thanks for that, Robert. Yeah, grace is a wonderful word for the moment. I do want to shift gears here now because there has been a Boston College brouhaha, and it has been sort of at the vanguard of town and gown tensions after Boston College had an outbreak of coronavirus cases. 12 positives this week, but that's down from 73 in a single week last week, more than half of their total cases so far. And City of Newton Mayor Ruth Ann Fuller pushing Boston College to change its approach, to be more collaborative, and then Governor Charlie Baker taking over some of the contact tracing activities. I think we've got sound of Governor Baker talking about that decision earlier this week.
In this particular case, Boston College had campuses in three different communities. That's a lot of handoffs, and one of the things we talked to them about, which they agreed to do, and so did the three communities they operate in, was to make the contact tracing collaborative, which can handle multi-jurisdictional places more effectively. The overseer of the tracing program associated with the BC program.
So is the governor right to take over there, Howard, do you think?
Well, I think you have to streamline. I think that this is the area where we're talking about leadership. And I think this is one of the areas where, you know, right or wrong, someone's got to make a call. And I think it's the right call, in my opinion, simply because I feel like the more diffuse the space, you know, the more diffuse the region, the more difficult it's going to be to contact trace. So you're going to have cooperation. And I think that when I think about the BC situation, the very first thing I'd heard there was the sort of lack of cooperation. And if ever you need to have some sort of communication, if ever you need sort of leadership, as we've seen over this time, now is it.
So I got some sound to kind of underscore that. We had the key parties on Radio Boston this week. First, here is Newton Mayor Ruth Ann Fuller being pretty gracious, not gloating that the state stepped in, and talking about that coordination.
We very much need Boston College to be an active partner with the health departments here in Newton, in Brookline, and in Boston, as well as with the state. So that's good news that they're committed to doing that.
Now, at the same time, tensions between Mayor Fuller and BC have been tough for a while. We had BC spokesman Jack Dunn on Monday, and he was pretty open about the bad blood between the institutions.
Well, we're disappointed, quite honestly, that the mayor has attempted to politicize the issue. We don't have good relationships with Mayor Fuller, but our focus is on Boston College and what works very well for us, and we think we have an excellent plan in place.
Governor Swift-Jane, can we afford this kind of standoff between town and gown in this moment?
So I think we've spent a ton of time focused on K through 12 and the real need to think about the right model for the educational future of our children. And it's ironic to me that all the focus on the higher education system has been around the students and the town gown relationships as super spreaders. Maybe I'm a little defensive because I'm the mother of three college students, but also just as a education professional, you know, I think we need to take a step back in Massachusetts. One of the great strengths of our economy are all these institutions of higher education. They are under enormous stress, and none of us are going to be happy if we wake up in a year and all of the stress of this pandemic and the additional things that we decide to heap on them results in a bunch of them cutting jobs or going out of business. We rely on our higher education institutions to educate our workforce, to provide jobs for our friends and neighbors. I live in a community that is dominated by a local college. And so I know the fears folks have about bringing the virus in, but I think that needs to be balanced by not only asking them to be good neighbors, but for us to also be good neighbors in return, and understanding that, you know, they're facing enormous challenges right now. So no, I don't think it's good to have a major institution and the political leadership at loggerheads. And so kudos to the governor for stepping in on this one.
Yeah, Tatiana, let's bring in a call. Yeah, Howard, jump in.
I was just going to say quickly, but I live in Northampton. I live in the five college area. So we've got the five colleges here out in Western Mass. And this has been the question. And I think that one of the big issues as we talk about shutdown or should we start, I appreciated what was being said over at BC as well, that we felt a responsibility to get moving on this, because what's really happening right now, as opposed to what was taking place a few months ago, is you're really starting to look at the financial imperatives taking place. And you don't want to sound callous about it, but these issues are very real, especially as the weather gets colder.
Let's bring in a caller voice, somebody with some experience here, 800-423-8255. We've got Meg on the line from Beverly. Meg, you work at a university, yes?
Yes, yes, I do. I work at one of the state universities.
So go ahead.
Okay. I chose to, as faculty, we were given the choice to teach distance teaching or teach face-to-face. And I was a bit of on the fence until I heard that during the summer sessions, there were students who were absolutely terrified to be on campus because they were in groups with strangers in the time of COVID. But at the same time, there was a student population who felt safer being on campus, and also students who need to have that face-to-face contact with their professors and the interaction with the academic exchange with classmates. And so that tipped it for me to definitely decide to be face-to-face. And I also work with first-year students, so I felt that they're the students who are going to be joining that new experience. It's supposed to be different from high school, and they're growing. And so I decided to be there for them.
Are you glad you did, Meg?
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad to be there. And I think the students are grateful also, because I'm finding, one student said to me, I'm reaching out to you because you are the only person that I have been able to kind of make a relationship with, because all the students' other classes are Zoom fashion. And so at the same time, the students, I think there's not enough presence on campus of others. And so
Meg,
for
thank
me,
you. I'm sorry to cut you off there. I'm going to take it back from you. I'm sorry, Meg, but I got to go to a break in just a second. But I think that's the heart of it that we're going to have to continue to watch, right, is this balance between the personal needs and the community public health needs. Governor Jane Swift, Howard Bryant, stay with us. When we come back, we're going to shift gears. We're going to take a look at a number of news stories involving criminal justice and the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, including the death this week of Chief Justice Ralph Gantz. That's what's coming up. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering, and still with us are ESPN writer Howard Bryant and former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. And you, call us. Let's talk about a number of important events involving the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court this week and what they mean for criminal justice in the Commonwealth. Have you reflected on the death of Chief Justice Gantz this week? Are you surprised by the sentencing study he commissioned that clearly found racial bias in charging and sentencing? And what does it mean that Governor Charlie Baker will have the chance to have appointed all members of the SJC? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I do want to start this week with the death of Chief Justice Ralph Gantz at the age of 65, which really sent a shockwave through Boston's legal community. Jane, did you know him?
I did not know him, but the study he commissioned is so important. You know, we have seen these statistics around the country. They've driven criminal justice reform at a national level, but it is telling that we still have so many issues to deal with here in Massachusetts, and would attribute to him to have the study he commissioned come out. And I feel terrible for his family. What a loss for the Commonwealth.
Howard, to that point, we talked with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner on Monday, just after the news of Justice Gantz's dying, on Radio Boston. She talked about him and his legacy with that study.
He was an exceptional judge, and he was a gentle and persuasive leader. There were no major divisions on this court. They simply did their job, and they did it well. I just wrote last week about his initiative to study racial disparities in the trial court system, which was a gutsy and significant thing to do. I mean, this is an unimaginable loss.
So then here comes, just by sort of the kismet of timing, here comes this study with hard data demonstrating racial disparities in charging outcomes, sentencing. I'm going to ask you what I asked Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins this week about those findings. Are you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised by it at all, considering as an African-American and as someone who's paying attention to these issues across the country anyway. I think the only time I'm surprised is when people are surprised. But when it came to Judge Gantz, what I found most sad about this and powerful about it and reasons why we need to pay more attention to these things is that it was an example to me that there are people behind these systems. We use these terms such as system and systemic and institutional and all of these things, and they're all so impersonal. And then when you have a judge who steps in and says, no, I'm going to commission these studies, and I'm going to find the data, and I'm going to use the power of my position to actually create some sort of pathway to understanding what's taking place within these systems. This is the power of the system. This is exactly what it's meant to be, and this is why the loss is going to loom so large.
So let's hear a little bit about the findings of that study. Here's Harvard Sentencing Study researcher Felix Owusu, a PhD student at Harvard, breaking down the disparities for WBUR.
Black and Latinx people facing drug or weapons charges are more likely to be convicted. They're more likely to be incarcerated than white people facing similar charges, and they do also receive longer sentences.
Jane, as we looked at the study, for example, even after controlling for demographic factors, previous criminal history, you're looking at nearly a month longer in sentencing for black and brown people on trial than white people. How deep does that bias go in the state's criminal justice system? And if you're the head of a state, where do you begin to tackle it?
Well, I think, first of all, as has been said, it's about having the data. And clearly, this is an issue that has plagued systems around the country. But I think you need to do training. You need to diversify the bench as another reason to make sure you have more diverse voices. As Howard said, he didn't surprise him because he's experienced it. And one of the reasons I've always supported diversity in leadership positions is because that is how lived experience impacts real decisions. And so I think those are two things that you can change right away.
So then, Howard, the Supreme Judicial Court issues a ruling on Thursday, both to expand the case that black people can make in court about whether they were racially profiled in arrests, and we'll get to this the second part a little bit more in a minute, and ruling on what is sort of proof of suspicious activity. Again, surprising to see this come out of Massachusetts' highest court in this moment. Obviously, the legal process would have started a while ago.
Yes, no question. And I think that the process is, once again, I think surprise is such an interesting term, but I feel like this has been across the board. We have been in sort of a situation where everything this year
is amplified because of COVID, because of George Floyd, because of the sort of shift that we feel in the country. But I do feel like this is one of the types of areas where there are so many people who are working on this every single day. And so surprise is the tough word for me. I don't want to trip on it, but I do feel like to what the governor was saying, I do feel like one of the most important things that we can do here is not just have the training, but also listen to the data. I feel like when it comes to these types of areas, especially when we're talking about criminal justice, because it feels institutional, but it's also very personal, is that we have a tendency to ask for the data, receive the data, and then treat the data emotionally. I think we need to listen to it, and then from there you can begin to decide, listen to it, and then believe it, and then you can move forward with the proper steps of redress.
You know, it's a really interesting point, Howard, especially because in that finding, one of the things the court basically said was there was previous precedent requiring a defendant or a complainant, that's the better word, to have statistical data to demonstrate that there was racial profiling. Then going on to say, hey, except that data is not transparent, you can't get it. that's not available. And so we can't give people a burden of proof that they are not capable of getting out of the system. Jane, how hard is it? I mean, we're in the middle of a police reform debate, and it seems to be locked at the State House right now. How hard is it to get law enforcement to consistently and transparently produce the kind of data that Howard's talking about?
So I think, you know, it can be very hard to produce the data. I think we also, I taught a class at BC last semester, and there's a new film out on Netflix called The Social Dilemma, and it also features the same book that I taught by Kathy O'Neill that talks about how you also have to be careful with data. It's called The Weapons of Math Destruction, because you also want to make sure you design the algorithms and the math and how you collect the data to not have bias integrated into how the data is collected. And yeah, so I think that you collect the data, you also need to make sure the people who are putting together how the data is collected and how it's presented themselves don't have bias. So these are complicated issues, but clearly need immediate action.
Yeah, Tiziana, so I was going to say, you also see with what's happening in New York, both ProPublica and the New York Civil Liberties Union both published this summer, I think it was in July, actually, the police misconduct database from the Citizens Board. And you see how much the police unions wanted to protect that information. And so once again, there is this sort of, there's a sunshine element to it, which needs to be acknowledged. But also when we talk about sort of redress and how to fix these things, I have been pretty flummoxed by the fact that people talk so much about training. And yet whenever I do stories and when I talk to defense attorneys on this subject, they constantly tell me that one of the bigger issues isn't really necessarily training. It's also the fact that it's the ignorance of training, that when you're in the field and when you're in real time, that so much of the training gets ignored. So I start thinking about, you know, comparing that and then also with data as well, you have the information, you have some of these mechanisms in place, and then what happens when the human element gets involved?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me, Howard, about this case was that the SJC found that acting, quote, nervous and evasive, end quote, can no longer be used as proof of suspicious activity by a Black person for police to approach them, because it essentially said it's probably rational behavior for a Black person in some circumstances to be afraid of police officers who are approaching them. And I wonder if that gives the lie to some of the argument that's being made in this police reform debate, which the pushback has been, hey, we're pushing police reform of Massachusetts because of things that had happened elsewhere, other states, other places. Does that finding, and I'll ask you both this, does that finding by the SJC give the lie to that argument? Howard, jump in.
I'm deferring to you, Jane.
All right, Jane, it's you.
You know, I guess it probably does. One of the things that I found when I was in the governor's office is the challenge of complicated public policy issues is that solutions often are not linear. And when you fix one thing, you often cause unintended consequences. And so that's my hesitation, right? Like if there was a very simple solution, most people do have the right intentions. And so I just struggle to figure out why we've been unable to create the right set of solutions.
Yeah, it's really difficult. It's just going to be very, very difficult because so many times we spend time talking about answers when we haven't necessarily agreed on the question. And so that's when things get very, I would not argue that yes, it's very nerve-wracking to be around an element that you fear. I mean, I think anybody, when you're driving down the street and you see the, you know, police flash or whatever, you're wondering, is that for me? It's certainly even more frightening when you feel like you may be targeted. However, at the same time, that doesn't mean that you may not be committing a crime. So once again, these issues are not linear, as the governor said, and I do feel that there has to be some common sense. But at the same time, I feel like sometimes it feels completely intractable, but on other areas, it really does feel like we're trying very hard not to pay attention to some of the information that is directly in front of us.
We have been talking this hour about stories where the rubber meets the road, where big questions we've been asking are starting to get answered. And one big area of speculation has been, is Michelle Wu running for mayor? Well, she answered that this week, kind of after Boston Mayor Marty Walsh sort of answered it for her last week. So listeners, join the conversation with your reactions. Did you think she would run? Did you think she wouldn't? Who else might get into the mayoral race for the city of Boston? And could there be a different kind of outcome for the city than there has been before? Can Wu or someone else do the impossible and unseat a popular mayoral incumbent in Boston? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Jane and Howard, it's kind of been an open secret that Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu wanted to run for mayor. She was the first woman of color elected to the council, as council president. Two-time top vote getter in the city's at-large elections, frequent critic of the Walsh administration. Your reactions to the announcement and the timing, Jane?
So I think it will make for a robust campaign season. It's interesting, right? Because historically, this has not been a path to election. Most of the time incumbents, particularly when they're popular, have won in Boston. However, we've seen some upsets, not so many in this last election cycle, but certainly a couple of years ago. So I think it will remain to be seen whether or not we're returning to sort of Boston's typical reelecting incumbents, who folks are generally happy with how they've done their job, or if it follows more of the pattern that we've seen on the national level, where newcomers with a different profile are able to upset an incumbent.
Yeah, the day that she announced, we had a Councilor Wu on Radio Boston, asked her this question about, I think it's been since like 1947, was the last time, 49, excuse me, that somebody unseated an incumbent mayor in Boston. And we asked her, you know, can she do it? Here's what she said.
You know, the reality as a city that is full of history is we know no one is the first until they do it and it happens. What I like to emphasize is that we're actually building a movement here to connect with the real history of Boston, our legacy as a city that has always stood up for what is right, even when the odds are slim.
So, Howard, there she is talking about building a movement, and we heard Jane just a minute ago talk about the fact that there is precedent now in Boston, in the districts around Boston, for some shakeups, for women of color to take on seats of white male incumbents, for real change. Does she have a shot of taking advantage of that wave, or is this more like Joe Kennedy trying to ride that wave unsuccessfully with Ed Markey.
Well, one of the interesting things about that race was that one of the people who is in line or one of the vanguards of this sort of new movement, AOC, was actually a Markey person. So when you start to look at this, it's complicated, right? I mean, I think that there is no doubt that where we are today, you could make an argument that all bets are off, that there's this new wave that's coming. Eventually it's coming, right? I mean, at some point, people have been talking about this since I think, Governor Swift, you can correct me on this, but I believe it was the early 90s where people were talking about Boston soon becoming the majority minority city, that there was going to be this new blood, that the wave of the demographics in the city were going to overtake the old guard. And it really has never happened in the 30 years since. It really hasn't happened. And so at some point, you do have to assume that this new guard, and someone's going to have that sort of energy to tap into supposedly what this new Boston looks like. Is it Michelle? I don't know. But I definitely feel, and especially at her age, born in 1985, where you are right now, that is that sort of period where you have that sort of philosophical difference, too, between old and new, that sort of mid-millennial place.
Jane, I'm guessing you have some thoughts about women and firsts in electoral politics.
So, well, it's hard to be first. I could tell you that. But I think what is interesting, so there has been change right in the city council. The city council looks very different in Boston than it looked when I served in Massachusetts politics 20 years ago. But the mayoral office does not look very different at all. I think, Har brings up a good point about who aligned with whom in the fourth or in the U.S. Senate race. And my take is, I think that what Michelle Wu will have to do is, yes, generational shifts are important, but at the end of the day, you're going to have to make an argument to the voters that there will be a difference to them. And that has to do with issues. And I think when 100%. You can combine the generational shift with a focus on a particular issue that you believe has not been attended to, that's when you can see these sort of seismic results. And I think we are yet to see that develop.
Just want to throw that number out to listeners again, 800-423-8255. What do you make of the unfolding mayor's race in Boston? Are more candidates better for the city? And what do you want to see as candidates, as policy platform? 800-423-8255. Howard, it sounded like you were going to add something there.
Well, I was just going to ask about what is that galvanizing issue, and what is the issue that you feel is going to connect those voters. If we're talking, one of the big stories in Boston, obviously, is transportation, right? That is the big thing that is what is broken? Can it be fixed? What is the solution to fixing it? Generationally, obviously, the one question that all of us from, if you're of a certain generation, if you're over, you're in your mid-40s, or if you're in your 50s or 60s, the question has always been, how are you going to pay for it? This new generation doesn't quite ask that question the same way our generation asked it. So I think there has to be a way, or there's got to be a pathway for you as the challenger to connect to the older guard voters and to say to them that there is a pathway here and that you're going to benefit from this, even though it runs completely counter to how we were raised.
So, I don't want to miss in the middle of all of this, too, as just kind of the picture of how things are unfolding, the kind of serious flexing, for lack of a better word, that we've been seeing from Marty Walsh, who has, in fact, not said whether or not he is running for re-election. Here he is responding to the news that Wu got in the race at a press conference on Tuesday.
I look forward to more conversations about how we can move our city forward. But right now we're battling the COVID-19 pandemic. We are working to rebuild our economy to help workers and small businesses.
So, the response, hey, I'm leading us right now through this great crisis. He knows he's got high approval ratings on that. And he's, you know, I've got my eyes on the business at hand. And at the same time, he essentially pre-announced Wu's candidacy a week before when the Boston Globe called him to ask him to confirm whether she had called him to say she was running. And he basically said, yep, she's running. Those are some pretty big flexes. Do they look good for him? And do they signal the way he might enter into a campaign? I welcome you, either of you, to weigh in on that.
So I would just say, I think that's all inside baseball, and we could have a lot of fun talking about, do you do this? Do you do that? It's a stuff, you know, political animals, like even I will admit, don't tell my husband, you know, we have fun. I have fun still thinking about all those things. Most real voters who will decide this election really don't think about that stuff, I don't think.
Howard, you were kind of chuckling about it.
Yeah, well, you love that it's part of the punditry, right? And whether or not did she have the opportunity to announce it for herself. And I like this. I don't know if like is the right word, but I was sort of laughing at the fact that you sort of have the mayor not really showing his hand. What is he going to do? Maybe he's thinking in the middle of a pandemic, maybe is this what you really want to do? Or is this really what I want to do? So interested in seeing how this plays out in terms of what his decision is going to be. But I think Jane is right. Obviously, when it comes down to what the people are going to respond to, what we care about in media is really not what they pay very much attention to.
Let's grab a call on this. We've got Hunter on the line from Wrentham. Hunter, go ahead.
Yeah. So as a young progressive, even out in the suburbs, I ran for local office in my area. I work on a number of campaigns in the area, and it's absolutely brilliant to see a young progressive running to make some real change in Boston. Boston's a deeply unequal city. You go from Dorchester to Back Bay, and you see massive disparities in terms of life expectancy, healthcare, income, and I think Michelle's going to do a wonderful job if she gets in there to try and address some of that. So I think it's brilliant. I was glad to see Tito Jackson run last time. I'm glad to see her running this time, and I really hope she gets in this time.
Thanks for that call, okay. Hunter. And so, Howard, you know, that's a progressive voice. And as Jane, sorry, it might have been even you, but I think it was Jane said earlier, we are seeing a very different Boston City Council now. It's the most female city council. It's the most racially diverse city council. Is the progressive tie just here in Boston?
Yeah, it's a really big deal, and I'm glad your caller said that, because I actually think one of the big questions, too, in terms of, you know, local versus national, is to really see what Joe Biden does with the progressive vote this year, and not just the progressive vote, but also the farther left vote, because if he continues to play the middle to the right and tries to go and win their votes because they're the ones statistically who vote more, and the progressives feel like they got left out, or that they were either taken for granted or that their voice wasn't heard, I think you're going to feel that even more locally. And once again, you listen to what the caller said. You hear it. I hear it all the time, what people actually really care about, that I, in my lifetime, have never really seen such a sustained sort of referendum on just capitalism in general. This new generation, I don't want to call them kids, I'm 51, but these kids in their, you know, late 20s, mid-30s, they just view it differently. They view this differently, and I really want to see what that is going to translate to politically.
Well, that's been a great conversation. I would love to keep going with it, but before we run out of time, I do want to leave space for our hubbubs. We all love them. Those are those local stories or events that caught our attention this week. Jane, why don't you go first?
So at my hubbub, I saw that a GBH reporter took note that Governor Charlie Baker's team did not let them photograph him getting his flu shot because he said he had to get partially undressed. And so as we talk about the mayoral race, I can tell you this, if a female candidate had said something like that, it would have made wide headlines. So there's one disparity between male and female candidates, and some of the offhanded comments that you can potentially make. Having said that, everybody should get their flu shot.
Amen to that. And oh my God, what you're saying is so true, right? If a woman had said that, it would have just played out in an entirely different way. All right, Howard, I have also been looking forward to your hubbub. Enlighten us.
Well, I am calling a bit of an audible. I'm gonna split it down the middle. I was gonna say in the first segment that one of the things to pay attention to as we look toward the COVID incidences on college campuses, especially Boston College, is the disparity between how the universities around the country, the big college sports programs, have decided to just move forward, whether there are players on campus or athletes on campus or not. And it really does give the lie to amateurism and also access to testing. And I know that was a big deal this week, how many tests are actually being administered to the regular students when the university, the athletes are being tested almost daily around the country. So it's going to be really interesting to see. But the split is, of course, we have to pay attention to the Boston Celtics. And I still feel, even though they're down 2-0, even though they blew 2 games, they are still an extremely talented team. I would be very, very surprised if they went out with a whimper. But last night's loss, which was accompanied by a shouting match with the team in the locker room afterwards, it doesn't look good, folks.
So, Howard, let's stay on this for just a second, because there was this shouting match that we then heard about in the locker room afterward. It's a relatively young team with a relatively young coach. What is it going to take for them to crawl out of that?
Well, they got to get tougher, and it's not a young team. They look young because they're younger than us, but they've been waiting. They've been knocking on the door. These guys, you know, they had a chance to go 2 years ago. They got blown out last year by Milwaukee, and they know what this opportunity is. They're really, really close to getting to the finals, and I think to see the lack of execution at the end of the last 2 games, it sort of blew up. It can go one of 2 ways. They can either fall apart and blame each other like they did last year, or they can make last night them a tougher team, and then we're in for something really special.
I'm going to start walking my dog in the third quarter.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. The Celtics are known for their great third quarters, but not anymore. My goodness.
Oh, last night was painful. Jane, so you've been watching the games?
I have. I'm a big sports fan, Tatiana.
So just out of curiosity to the both of you, are you paying attention to Cam Newton and the Pats as they come forward?
Of course.
And Howard, I guess you probably have to.
It's an occupational hazard not to, but I'm wondering what is the actual calendar date when somebody is going to allow the Patriots to do whatever the Patriots do, or the Buccaneers to do whatever the Buccaneers are going to do, without combining the two. Those two, because you're paying attention to big number 12 down there. It matters.
That's right. All right. Now, for my hubbub, it's not really a hubbub. I just want to bid Shana Tova today to our Jewish listeners as they enter one of the high holidays. Rosh Hashanah begins at sundown tonight. Religious communities are all having to really renegotiate these sacred moments, and my thoughts are with you. Well, Howard Bryant, Jane Swift, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Thanks for being on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. And join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.